Dear listeners to Lehigh Valley Discourse, I bet you do not know what DACA stands for. Well, you're going to learn this evening. I'm John Pierce, along with Elizabeth Parcells, and this is Lehigh Valley Discourse. We're going to be chatting with Dr. Erica Sutherland, and she is very heavily involved in this organization called DACA. Erica, what does DACA stand for?
Well, I hate to start out in the interview by correcting you, but I need to.
All right, go ahead.
DACA is actually not an organization. The organization that I'm with is called the Grupo de Apoyo e Integración Hispanoamericano, the Hispanic Immigrant Support Group here in the Lehigh Valley. DACA is actually a federal program. It stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and it was implemented by executive order in the summer of 2012 by President Obama. When he discovered that, much to his chagrin, it was impossible to pass meaningful immigration reform in the Congress. So he looked at to see what he could do in terms of an executive action, and he created DACA to allow for students who came in, children who came in as children with their parents and either came in undocumented or stayed beyond their legal status to become undocumented. And the idea being that a children should not pay for the sins of the parents, of the fathers, the DACA allows those young people to have a shot at continuing their education, at getting a job, at really becoming a full part of the American fabric, because this is where they grew up. And I look forward to talking more about what DACA is.
Absolutely. Dr. Sutherland is Associate Professor of Spanish at Muhlenberg College. And as she said, she's the director of the Grupo de Apoyo e Integración Hispanoamericano. So that's the support and integration group for Latin America, so that all of the immigrants with whom you're working are Hispanic?
Well, we started out that way. As word of our presence has spread around the valley, we routinely get calls from there's a small but growing number of African immigrants coming in, so we routinely field questions from there. We also have a small but growing number of Francophone Caribbean immigrants who've reached out to us. Because we work in immigration, we can really help just about anybody. It just so happens that we do a lot of our work in Spanish, so that the outreach materials we produce are in Spanish, which makes it easier for Hispanics. Again, not so much the young people who tend to be fully English-speaking. Most of the young people with whom we're working have grown up here and have been educated here, so English is no impediment. But for their parents, for their grandparents, that's where the complications come in.
Dr. Sutherland received her PhD in Spanish literature from the University of Pennsylvania, and I'll bet when you did that work, you had no idea you were going to be involved with anything like DACA or this organization in the Lehigh Valley.
Well, I grew up in Washington, D.C., the daughter of fairly activist parents during the Vietnam War. So I think the idea that you're called to be an activist, you're called to speak out against injustice, is very much in my blood and very much part of my upbringing. So although I think you're right, I wouldn't have guessed I'd be working with Hispanic immigrants in the Lehigh Valley. I have to say, when I take groups down to giant protests in Washington, I'm truly going home.
So you're from Washington, D.C.
originally? I grew up in Washington, D.C. I was born in Cleveland, but I grew up in Washington, yeah.
Erica Sutherland joined Muhlenberg College's Department of Languages, Literatures, and Cultures in 1995. That's 20 years now.
It's 20 years
and
now.
And counting. Teaching courses for the Spanish section in language and especially literature and cultures of Spain. Her scholarly research focuses especially on the relation between literature and society. And that's where your interest in what's going on with immigration comes in, too.
Well, again, yes and no, because I think that I grew up concerned that it's easy to become a professor and to be an intellectual without being a public intellectual, without really connecting with the issues of the day. So although my scholarly work mostly focuses on literature from Spain, dealing with where connections between literature and medicine in particular, women's issues in particular, that fits into a broader vision of what an educator should be. I really believe that as a professor, you're given the gift of a public speaking place and a little bit of authority from which to speak. And I'm happy to use that to make the world a better place.
And also from the standpoint of students, nowadays students are encouraged to get out into the community.
Absolutely.
Much more than when you and I studied. We were in a bubble.
Absolutely. And in fact, Muhlenberg's been doing an amazing job of creating not just opportunities for students to do community service, but actually to do what's called service learning, where the community collaboration work is woven into the work of a course. It's really a wonderful pedagogy, an active pedagogy. Muhlenberg's been doing an amazing job with that. And I have to say, our Office of Community Service and Civic Engagement is a leader, I think, in the Valley with that. All of the LVAC colleges, Lafayette, Moravian, DeSales, Lehigh, and Cedar Crest are active in some way in terms of service learning. But I think Muhlenberg's been taking a really proactive, thoughtful stance towards service learning, where in almost any department you've got some sort of course that involves community work, experiential work, where working with the community, and I do mean working with the community, not just in the community, but with the community, becomes an essential part of the course.
Well, what's the difference between working in the community and working with the community?
Well, it's the difference between going out to do good for other people and to go out to do good with other people, in that rather than being the saviors from the suburbs, they're actually programs that are forged to do projects with people living in marginal communities, in depressed communities, in depressed situations, so that rather than having someone with more power, i.e., an elite student from an elite college, going into a non-elite area to solve a problem, they're actually working with people from marginal neighborhoods, marginal communities, so that together they're working on problems and together they're finding solutions and together they're creating what turns out to be a much more sustainable solution. Plus, of course, for the students, it's important for them to understand that they're not here to save the world. They're here to work with the world and to work in the world, so that's a lesson that they take with them. That's absolutely crucial.
And it's obvious that you are very much involved in this whole area of working with community participants and getting students off
Absolutely.
The campus and getting them into other areas. What are some specific courses that you teach where you do that?
Well, in Spanish, I teach two courses. One is, they're both called Spanish for the Community. One is then subtitled Translation, and the other is subtitled Interpreting, where I'm teaching students, our advanced students, the very specialized skills of oral interpreting or written translation, where the students spend their class hours learning how to be a translator, how to be an interpreter. But then their out-of-class hours are spent working with a community organization, doing translations for that organization or interpreting for that organization. Now, that can be a fairly loose thing because our students aren't really ready to be professional interpreters or professional translators quite yet, but they can work in partnership with a team of collaborators from the community, or alternately, for example, with Lehigh County Conference of Churches, they work in the Pathways program, not so much as interpreters, but really doing the work of the Pathways volunteers, but doing it in Spanish. So they're providing a service that Pathways needs to a client base that needs the service to be provided, and they're doing it in Spanish. So they're getting that learning experience of negotiating language and culture while they're providing a service.
You mentioned the Council of Churches. What are some of the other organizations? Because you're based in Allentown.
We are based in Allentown, but our students aren't necessarily based in Allentown. And particularly these advanced courses often appeal to some of our adult students through the Wesco School. So we have students who might be based in Easton or even up in Lehighton, for example. So we work with organizations that fit the students' needs. We have a couple regulars, the law offices of Jane Schoner and Katie Alborelli. Well, technically, the law offices of Jane Schoner and Katie Alborelli is one of the attorneys. It's an immigration law firm. And although we normally wouldn't partner with a for-profit business, they do a tremendous amount of pro bono work in the community, particularly for victims of domestic violence or victims of serious crimes. And as a way of, in a sense, paying back or paying forward, I'm not sure how to put it, the immense amount of pro bono work that they do with our immigrant group. Our students are able then to offer that service of being an interpreter while having that extraordinary learning experience of learning what they can do and what they can't do as an interpreter or as a translator.
So as a translator or interpreter, what are some of the things that one cannot do?
Well, you can't change the story. That would be the single biggest thing. You have to stay true to the message of the original communication. So, for example, if a person has a problem, you don't want to try to explain that problem. You want to just say whatever the person has said. In a medical setting, for example, you can't extrapolate and you can't lead vocabulary. You need to stick to the vocabulary that's there. If the patient says, my elbow hurts, you can't say the arm hurts, for example. And that sounds like a little thing, but it can actually be a really big thing. Those are the things you can't do. The other thing is you really can't offer your own advice. And we know that when a non-English speaker, a person with limited English, comes into contact with an interpreter, particularly in a stressed situation, for example, in a legal situation, in a medical situation, in a social service situation, they're very stressed. And often whatever little English they have goes out the window just because of the stress. It's a very natural. It happens in any language in a stress situation. But they will really lom on to the Spanish speaker, and they'll turn to that Spanish speaker, and they want to have advice, and they have questions, and they want to tell their story. And our student interpreters learn, first and foremost, you have to learn to say no and just say, I can only repeat what you've said and communicate to the other person. As we say, our interpreters need to be like pieces of glass, that they're invisible and the communication goes through them.
It's a really special and specialized talent to be able to do this kind of interpreting and translating, too.
Being bilingual is not the same as being an interpreter or being a translator. It's actually a pretty big difference. And particularly when we have heritage speakers or even native speakers coming to our class, that's one of the first things they have to learn. It's not enough to be bilingual. You have to have that skill as well.
And what exactly is a heritage speaker as opposed to
a... Well, a native speaker is someone who grew up and was educated in their mother tongue. A heritage speaker is someone who grew up in a family where mother tongue was spoken, but grew up going to schools, in this case, English. So, for example, many, many Hispanic immigrants speak Spanish at home, and yet all of their formal education is in English. And so although they can speak and listen in their second language, they may not have the grammatical precision, and they may not be able to read or write at the same level of their speaking and reading, as they're speaking and listening. It's a really interesting group. There's a lot of research out on what makes them so special. But from my perspective as a teacher and not a specialist in that area, I just find it fascinating to be able to leverage the skills that they bring to the class and combine them with the skills that some of our non-heritage speakers, which are the majority at Muhlenberg, that they bring to the class. For example, their spelling's great, their grammar's great, but they don't have any of the fluidity. And in comparison, the heritage speakers are extraordinarily fluid and easy in their manner of speaking, but often have pretty bad spelling.
Yes, because they haven't practiced it.
Exactly. It's a skill. We all learn skills.
Exactly. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse, and this is Dr. Erica Sutherland, who teaches at Muhlenberg College and is very active with groups of immigrants who find themselves in this country, and particularly children who have grown up here. And that's our topic this evening. Dr. Sutherland, with her studies, concentrated in 19th century literary and medical images of the female body and gender-based violence. Ooh, this does not sound like something that you're doing today with the immigrants.
It is and it isn't. I do, to some extent, separate out my scholarly work with my community work, and the bridge happens in the classroom where, again, you have that sort of intermediate space between the articles that I write, which are, I guess, geeky is the best way to put it.
Scholarly.
and then the work I do in the community, which is really as grounded as could possibly be. And I think the classroom space is that intermediate space where you bring together those two things and seek to inspire the students. I've always been interested in medicine. I grew up knowing I was going to be a doctor. I just didn't realize it was going to be a PhD as opposed to an MD. And it wasn't until I really fell in love with languages and literatures that I decided that that was the path. But now, deeper into my career, I realized that interest in medicine never went away. It's just been manifested in a different way. So I do work a lot with medical images, images of disease, images of violence, and how the female body particularly comes out in all of that.
As a girl, you were sort of heading toward an MD.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. Absolutely.
And at what point did that change?
Freshman year of college. Two things happened. One, first year science classes were actually difficult, which was an incredible shock to me. I had done quite well in high school. I'd always been quite the science person in high school and had taken all of my APs and had placed out, and I was taking them for fun in college, and they were no longer fun and they were no longer easy. And that was kind of shocking to me. The other thing was, I just realized I'd never questioned why I wanted to be a doctor. It was something that I'd grown up with, and I'd just known that that's what I was going to be, but I'd never really questioned it. When I got to college, away from the family, finally able to take a deep breath and say, well, what is it that really makes me happy? Where do I feel like a whole person? Where do I feel like I have something new to bring to the table? And it absolutely had to do with languages and cultures.
Interesting. Dr. Sutherland is currently preparing a 2-volume critical anthology of Spanish women writers. So again, this is the side of you that's academic.
Scholarly.
Scholarly, yes. And we're talking this evening more about the side of Dr. Sutherland, which is reaching out to the community and working with folks who have immigrated to this country and now have children who have been born here, most of them.
Well, DACA actually applies, it does not apply to children who were born here, because children who are born here are citizens and eligible to all of the rights and benefits of any American citizen. DACA, which is the topic of today's conversation, is really for the for kids who were born in another country and who were brought into this country as children. They have to have arrived before they turn 16.
And we're going to continue our chat with Dr. Erica Sutherland after this break. Stay tuned.
Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, call 610-694-8100, extension 6, or visit our website, wdiy.org.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
This evening, Dr. Erica Sutherland is informing us about what DACA is, which is a national organization. And again, it stands for?
It's actually not an organization. It's an executive action. It's a program, but not an organization. It stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Deferred action is a legal status that was implemented. Actually, I don't know when the first deferred actions were put in, but they've been used in large measure since the 1970s for different categories of immigrants. Deferred action means they're not subject to deportation. So they're not in a legal status. They don't have a green card, but nor are they illegal. So they're in an interesting legal limbo, but it's a formal legal limbo. So DA, the deferred action, and then childhood arrivals for kids who arrived as children.
And the children were born abroad.
Had to have been born abroad.
And this came under President Obama?
Yep, in the summer of 2012.
An executive action on his part.
Absolutely.
Do you have contact with other people around the country as far as DACA is concerned? Do you have meetings?
Well, there are routinely, actually weekly and monthly, conference calls and webinars to keep people up to speed. I am a full-time professor, so I often get my information distilled. So when there's an area of immediate interest, when there's changes brewing in Congress, when there's specific things coming up, for example, at the end of the first two-year period of DACA, DACA gives a two-year period of protection for the young people. At the end of the first two-year cycle, we were all on these webinars and on these conference calls to find out, well, how is the renewal process going to take place? Is it automatic? Is it all but guaranteed? What's going to happen to these people? So we do that. I work with the Pennsylvania Immigration Citizenship Coalition, PIC, based in Philadelphia, but with statewide affiliates. Grupo de Apoyo would be the Lehigh Valley affiliate. PIC, in turn, works with national organizations, including United We Dream, which is a group created, made up of, pushed forward, promoted the works by young people, most of whom are DACA, or if they're a little bit older, for whatever reason, can't get DACA, are actually undocumented. An amazing, energetic, very inspiring group of young people.
What's the age range to be considered a child in this?
You can apply for DACA as young as 16 and as old as 31. And these dates all stem back to 2012, to that initial date of the announcement. So new people can come in as they turn 16, can apply for DACA, but older people can't add on. So, for example,
what about children under 16?
They're not eligible for DACA. But because children under 16 tend to be a little bit less vulnerable than children over 16, they're not likely to be out looking for a job. They're not likely to be out hanging out in the street, getting into trouble, which we'd hope no young people are. But we know realistically teenagers tend to be more visible than small children.
Mm-hmm. So people who are eligible for DACA are 16 years up to
31.
31. And they were born abroad.
Had to have arrived in the country before turning 16. Had to have been in the country for at least 5 years by the time they apply for DACA. So, for example, if you arrived at age 16 on 2012, just before 2012, you'd have to wait till you're 21 to be able to apply for it, because you have to have been in the country before you were 16, but then you also have to have been in the country for 5 years. You cannot have committed any serious crime, and up to three misdemeanors are considered acceptable. And misdemeanors, remember that when we're talking about young people, we're often talking about possession of underage drinking, driving without a license, things that aren't serious crimes but are serious enough that the government takes note of them. So that's it. We recommend that anyone who has had any contact with the police of any shape, size, or form work with a lawyer too before jumping into the DACA process. It's a fairly straightforward process, and what our group does is train young people how to fill out the forms, how to do the applications, so they themselves are doing it without an attorney. We do have workshops where attorneys are present to answer any questions, again, particularly for any young person who's had any contact of any kind with either immigration or the police. Just to answer the question, that doesn't necessarily mean a young person can't get DACA, but they need to be clear about how to frame that encounter.
What was happening with children 16 to 31 before DACA came along? In other words, what was the reason that DACA turns out to be a good thing?
Well, we have a large number of undocumented people here in the country. Estimates range from 11 to 13 million. Some people would even argue more. And of that percentage, there's a lot of young people. And when you have young people who have gone through the school system, some arrive, remember, as babies, have been through kindergarten all the way up through 12th grade. Well, what do we want them to do when they graduate? Do we want them to graduate and do nothing, which is what the law technically says they should be doing. Some of these people no longer speak the language of the countries from which they come. If you've grown up and only had education in English, it's entirely likely that your Spanish is awful or not even present. And of course, remember, I work with Hispanic immigrants, but immigrants come from all over the world. So there's many, many languages, and some of them disappear. Is it reasonable to ask a child who at this point has no contact whatsoever with their home country to go back to that country where they may not have any relatives anymore, they may not have the language skills, they certainly don't have the cultural skills anymore, and they certainly don't have the contacts that are normal parts of growing up in a country? It makes much more sense in every sense of the world, just both in the sense of social justice, but also just in raw economics. If you invested in educating these young people, give them a chance to join the workforce, give them a chance to go on to higher education and then join the workforce at a higher level. It's not their fault they came into the country. We shouldn't be blaming them for what happened. But I think also, even getting away from the blame model, just say, we have an incredible investment here. This is a country founded on immigrants, and a lot of the new businesses being formed in this country, a lot of the houses that are being bought in this country, and specifically here in the Lehigh Valley, are by foreign-born individuals. Well, let's make sure that we can give them the support, the reasonable support that we can, to let them really become full-fledged members of the community. And again, DACA is not citizenship. It is not a path to citizenship. It's not a green card. I'd love to see it turned into that, frankly. I'll be very open about that. On the other hand, for now, it's a wonderful stopgap program to allow them to have a driver's license, have a social security card, have a work permit, and just to be able to take a little bit of a deep breath. The stress of knowing that you could be deported at any minute is pretty intense, and for undocumented families, it can be devastating with all kinds of health effects and just, I think, emotional effects.
Yes, indeed. I sometimes wonder what it would be like, and I can't really imagine what it would be like to be living where you're always dodging.
And you're always, every time you leave the house in the morning to go to work, wondering, am I going to come back to see my family tonight? And never really knowing. And here in the Lehigh Valley, where we really don't have a very good public transportation system, that means many, many, many people are out there driving. And that is, without competition, the biggest point of intersection between individuals and the police. And that can be devastating. That can really be devastating.
So DACA is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And you're saying, Erica, that without this executive order, these young people would go through their schooling, probably graduate from high school, and then not have any outlets.
Not have any legal outlets, that's correct. And so if they're working as undocumented workers, which opens them up to all kinds of labor abuses, wage abuses. It also opens up the invitation to be part of an underground economy, which I think we can all agree is not the economy where we want to have young, intelligent, bright, educated people working. We'd much rather have them in the formal economy.
And Dr. Sutherland is active with the Grupo de Apoyo e Integración Hispanoamericano here in the Lehigh Valley, and that is connected to PIC, which is?
PIC is a coalition, and we are one of the member organizations of the coalition, Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition, based in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. So there's lots of activity
going on
as far as immigrants is concerned and
very
immigration.
Much so.
And as you said, we're a country based on immigrants. Went to Ellis Island recently, and all you have to do is go there and just be blown away by the numbers of people who have come through there.
It's extraordinary.
Yes.
It's extraordinary. And when you think about the history of immigration and how really until the 1920s, there were no laws whatsoever regarding immigration. I hear a lot of people say, well, my grandparents immigrated here legally. Well, yes and no. If there's no laws, you can't really say who came in legally, who came in illegally, because there was no notion of legal versus illegal. And it wasn't until the 1920s that we had the first official laws regarding immigration. A lot of the laws were highly racist, eliminating, for example, immigration from the Far East, just prohibiting that, or the regulations that were in place weren't laws, immigration laws per se, but more health laws. You had to be healthy to come into the country. And that's a reasonable thing. I think a government has the right to say who's coming in. Now, I know we're going to be going down a long and twisted road if we start talking about the immigration laws today, but I think it does bear noting that the immigration process as it stands now is entirely broken. It takes far too long to come in legally. It's far too complicated, and far too many people are excluded from the very start, from that process. If you are a person who wants to work hard and may not be highly educated, but you may have specialized skills. You may just be very strong and willing to put your work. There is no line to wait in. There is no visa category for someone who is a good, strong worker. And frankly, our country needs good, strong workers. We need all kinds of workers. That's why people come, because they come here and they get work. But it's a shame to hear people with the mistaken notion that, well, why don't they just get in line and wait? There isn't a line to wait in for many, many immigrants. There simply is no line.
Do we still have quotas for certain parts of the world?
I don't like to use quota, but there absolutely are numbers associated with each country and with each category, with each visa category, absolutely. I can give an example of my stepdaughters. My husband is an immigrant from Panama. And the year he became a citizen, he petitioned to have his daughters, from his first marriage, come in. And although their green cards were approved fairly early on, to actually get the visa to get them in to get the green card for the oldest daughter, she turned 21 before the visa number came up. It took her 7 years. And this is for the daughter of a U.S. citizen now trying to come into the country. And although the Cooper family played by the rules and did everything exactly the way it was supposed to happen, I think that's an unreasonable limit. I think it's an unreasonable thing to ask a family to stay separated for 7 years. Because during while an application is pending, you cannot come in as a traveler, as a visitor. You cannot come in for any reason, because the government assumes you're just going to jump ship, basically, and stay. So a seven-year wait is really a seven-year wait.
In this case, your husband was here in the U.S.,
correct,
but could not be with his daughters except to go back and visit them.
He could visit them in Panama. They could not visit him here. Now both of the girls are here, and at this point they're both citizens and voting and happy, integrated members of the community, speaking English beautifully. They've just done an amazing job of integrating into American society. But 7 years, that's a long time to ask a family to stay separated. And we were lucky. We hear stories that it takes even longer.
We're talking about DACA, which is, it's a new acronym for me, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, an executive action by President Obama. And so my question right now, Erica, is what impact does DACA have on schools and colleges?
And those are two separate questions and two really interesting questions. First of all, I would like to say before there was DACA, often in high school, you'll see students who were super bright, really high achieving in elementary school and middle school. And then as they approach the end of high school, they sort of crash and burn. They stop attending, they start skipping, they start manifesting discipline problems. And part of that, it often had to do with the fact that they realized as they graduated, that was it. There was nothing more for them. They didn't have the hope of a job, not a legal job. College was something that was all but impossible. But with DACA, things have changed. The game has changed. Now students know they can graduate and start working. They can graduate and go on to college. And so I think in the high school level, you've got students who are going to be much more engaged. And we're excited to see that. And that's one of the things we've been working on with our group, to really get the message out to kids saying, Don't slow down. High school is not a time to slough off. That's your time where you pick up your game so you can get into a college. There are issues about going to college, and I actually have a map here to share with you. Sorry that the listeners can't see the map, but it's a cool map from UnitedWeDream.org. And it's a map of the different states where they have tuition equity, it's called. I would just call it access to higher education for undocumented or DACA students. They've come up with a cute new word, documented, as opposed to undocumented, documented. And different states around the country allow free access to universities and for state universities, allowing them both access to state universities, but also in-state tuition with the potential of financial aid. Pennsylvania is not one of those states. That's still something that gets negotiated on a student-by-student basis. Now, I should say all of the rules about getting students into state schools, of course, leaves out the private colleges. And I'm pleased to say here in the Lehigh Valley that I know of, three of the LVAC institutions have admitted both undocumented and documented students, giving them full financial support or the necessary financial support to complete an education. And it is so exciting. We had our first documented students graduate 2 years ago, and it's just great to see, well, I guess a year and a half ago now, to hear now a year out of graduation what they're doing and how they're really making a go of it. I've been quite a bit of a mentor to the DACA students that I know of at Muhlenberg, and it's really a joy and a pleasure to see them take advantage of something and just really run with the opportunity.
I would guess that at the Muhlenberg campus, you are the contact for DACA.
Well, of course, financial records are confidential, so unless I know about it, for example, if they came from my immigrant support group, I would know about them, but for fairly obvious reasons, I wouldn't know about everybody, so I can only speak to the students of which I know. No, of course, the financial records and immigration laws, I wouldn't be privy to just a random student's financial information or a random student's immigration status. But I will say that the financial aid office and the admissions office have been really extraordinarily giving and extraordinarily open to having those conversations with students and their families.
This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. We're ready for another break. Dr. Erica Sutherland is telling us about the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals on the national level, and also about the Grupo de Apoyo, which she directs here in the Lehigh Valley. And it has to do with immigrants, and particularly children, and what happens to them as they finish their schooling, their high school years. What opportunities are available? We'll continue after this break.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
As director of the Grupo de Apoyo e Integración Hispanoamericano, Dr. Sutherland, who is my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse, works with the unique gifts and needs of Hispanic immigrants. The immigrant support group began with the understanding that for many immigrants, a job, even a well-paying job, is not all they seek. The Grupo de Apoyo offers active and engaged immigrants practical resources such as immigration law advice and support, information about local issues, projects that facilitate civic engagement, and community actions that connect immigrants and non-immigrants. And that is a big part of what you're doing right now at Muhlenberg College.
Absolutely.
Do you teach something every semester that has to do with community outreach?
My Spanish for the Community course is scheduled to run every semester, interpreting in the fall, translation in the spring. It is an advanced class with a fairly limited number of potential students. So there have been semesters when we haven't had enough students to run it, in which case I run it as an independent study for those students who are able to do it. I do that because we really do have commitments with some of the local organizations, and if they're counting on having volunteer interpreters, I'd like to make sure that they do. Again, it's not just about our students, but it's also about our community partners. I also teach a first-year seminar. It's the one class I teach in English that has to do with the assimilation patterns of Hispanic immigrants. Cuisine as culture.
Cuisine as culture. I know that you're a big fan of different cuisines all around the world.
That's true.
And what do you do in that course exactly? Now, this is for freshmen, right?
This is for first-year students. And, of course, the main goal of a first-year seminar at Muhlenberg is to teach college-level writing and research skills. But having said that, as you said, I am a big fan, and big in the most literal of senses, of different cuisines. What we do is we take as the central question, what happens when an immigrant comes to a new community, a new geography? We know people bring their foods with them, but we also know it's impossible to eat the same food if you can't get the same food. So how do cuisines adapt to new communities, and how do communities change given the new arrivals of new seasonings, of new cuisines? And we use the Mexican community as our model, partly because we have a great textbook that does that by Gustavo Arellano. Taco USA, excellent book.
Besides, Erica, I just have to throw this in. My very favorite cuisine of the whole world is Mexican.
And it's very diverse and it's a sophisticated cuisine. It's a popular cuisine. And once you start looking at Mexican cuisine, even here in the Lehigh Valley, it is extraordinary, the variety. There's a restaurant on 4th Street in Allentown, Diego's. It's a little restaurant, but they have huitlacoche right now. Huitlacoche is, well, in English, you can either call it the fancy name, corn truffle, or the farmer's name, corn smut. It's the fungus that grows on corn. But as a cuisine, it's part of Mexican cuisine, and it tastes like a mushroom that tastes like corn. It's an amazing little ingredient. And, of course, it's only in season for a tiny part of the year. We happen to be in corn season right now. I know when this show airs, it'll be past corn season. But Diego's
has... We can look forward to next year.
Well, but Diego's has fresh huitlacoche quesadillas. And it's extraordinary. It's a gift, and it's something you will never find at Chi-Chi's. You will never find it on the border. It's something that really only an immigrant restaurant catering to an immigrant palate is going to know to present, and then actually have the skills and the access to get that.
So I can see you taking students on a field trip down to 4th Street.
We take students on field trips. 4th Street, actually, we don't go to. That's my private secret.
It's private no more.
But no, we do take students on to a series of restaurants, and then I break the students into teams representing different major Hispanic immigrant groups, because we do focus on the Hispanic community in this particular course. So we have one group looking at the Dominican community, and how they've integrated and how the food may or may not be a marker of that. We look at the Peruvian community, which of course is one of the oldest immigrant communities here in the Valley, second only to the Puerto Rican community. So we have Dominican, Peruvian, Colombian, and Salvadoran are the four groups that we break into. Again, using the model that Arellano sets up in Taco USA to look at how the Mexican cuisine has changed, become popular, and at the same time really broken into Mexican food for Mexicans and Mexican food for non-Mexicans, all of which is very, very tasty.
And you're actually claiming that all these countries that you named have different cuisine. It's not just all Mexican tasting.
Oh, gosh, no. In fact, even the question of something being spicy, Dominican food is about as unspicy as you'll get. Very savory, very flavorful, but not at all spicy. Colombian food, again, not at all spicy. Very, very flavorful, but no spices. Peruvian food, on the other hand, that's spicy. Quite spicy and quite delicious.
We've been talking about DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And, Erica, we've been highlighting the positive aspects of it, but there are some people who oppose DACA. What's that about?
Well, there are some people who believe that if you are not in this country legally, you should not be in this country. There certainly is a body of people, both in the public and in Congress, who would argue that way. For that matter, in our state government as well. My response is, I think we're better than that. I think that we should be better than that. And again, particularly when it comes to young people who at this point have already been educated here, by definition, the group who included for DACA, these are kids who grew up here, or at least did a significant chunk of their growing up here. So we've already made that investment, because remember, public education from kindergarten through 12th grade is a guarantee of this country. So we've already made that investment in educating them. Why not work with that investment and really let these young students, young people, come reach their full potential, either as workers or as going on to get more education and then go on to a different kind of professional work after college? It just makes sense to me. I also really believe that it's the right thing to do. And I think we don't often talk about doing things just because it's the right thing to do. And yet I'm here to stand on my soapbox and say, we can do it. We should do it. There's a lot of decisions we make that don't just make business sense. And this does. There's been tons of studies out showing that as soon as you get the immigrant community into the job force, salaries rise across the board. The more salaries rise, the more taxes are paid. The more taxes are paid, the better able people are to buy houses. And I should point out that at this point in Allentown, for example, more houses are owned by foreign-born owners than are owned by non-foreign-born owners. And that's an extraordinary statistic, that you have this commitment of immigrants coming in, commitment to the country. And I think that we should really be fostering that rather than slapping it down.
And you would say that that group of homeowners who were born abroad...
Mm-hmm. May or may not be undocumented immigrants, in fact. I mean, I need to put it out there. Foreign-born is not the same as undocumented. Those are two very, very different things. My husband, for example, is foreign-born, yet he's a U.S. citizen.
Right. And so of all these people who own houses, and you say it's more from that category than from people who were born here, mm-hmm. In Allentown. Those people have come to the Lehigh Valley in the last generation?
Well, if they're foreign-born, it would have to be within the last generation, because mm-hmm. we're not talking children of foreign-born, but we're actually talking about people who...
It's a fairly recent phenomenon.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I want to point out is that the school-age children in Allentown now, enormous percentage Hispanics. I think it's more than 50%.
72% in some of the schools, yeah. It's a pretty big number. In Allen High School, it's 72% Hispanic. So, in different other parts of the school system, 72 is the high number. Overall, according to U.S. Census, it's 42% in Allentown, but that of course includes some of the less urban parts of Allentown. It also may not include everybody. A census is not an entirely inclusive thing. In a way, a school statistic is.
What do you think the future holds for immigrant youth?
Well, I would like to think that it brings good things. I would hope that as young people are motivated to go on with their education, they will take that education and run with it to make a life better for those who come behind them. I think that's one of the goals that I certainly have, our group certainly has, to really foster in young people a sense that you have been given a gift. You have an extraordinary opportunity with DACA. Don't let it go. Don't let it go to waste. Make it something important. Make it something useful. Right now, there are discussions in Congress about creating a pathway to citizenship so that these young people actually have a chance to become citizens, to get a green card and eventually become citizens. As the law stands now, it's virtually impossible for that to happen. There are a few minor loopholes by which people who came in with a visa but overstayed a visa can indeed adjust their status at some point. If you came in without a visa to begin with, if you came in illegally, it's almost impossible to become to adjust your status to become legal without leaving the country with a 10-year ban. Again, 10 years is a long time to be out of the country, particularly if you're going back to a country where you may not speak the language, where you may not have family contact, and where, frankly, the situation could be pretty dangerous, as we know it is in different parts, particularly of Latin America, but more broadly around the world.
Many of our listeners are not immigrants. They do not have family members who are immigrants at this point. At some point, they were in the past.
I was going to say, I think just about all of our listeners are immigrants on some level.
If you go back to the 19th or 18th centuries. But why should these people care about immigrant youth today?
Well, I'll go back and start out by saying it's the right thing to do. We should care about our neighbors and the people with whom we live. But I think more broadly, there's an energy that comes from the people coming in from other countries. They bring an energy. They're here because they want to be, not because they have to be here. And when people come to a country, they come drawn by the opportunities that the United States represents, but also by the ideals that the United States represents, the ideals that of justice, where you can reasonably count on the police being the good guys, which is not an assumption that comes from other countries. Here we have all kinds of benefits that people appreciate. And when we give them an opportunity to participate in the community in that broadest sense, they do. I think also there have been studies. The Pew Hispanic Center has done multiple studies for years now, and each study shows that in areas where you have immigrant communities, you have lower levels of crime. In areas where you have immigrant communities, going blank on this one. In areas where you have immigrant communities, you have a stronger commitment to the community, house buying being one marker, being involved in a church being another marker. We've heard hand-wringing about bowling alone, how people don't belong to groups. Well, immigrants actually do belong to groups. They do join clubs. They do join churches. They do take part in civic organizations. It's a positive, something good. And then the final thing is where there are immigrant communities, you have economic well-being. You have new businesses being started. You have houses being rented, houses being bought. You have simply people buying things and paying sales tax. You have people paying income tax. Now, some people might say, well, wait a second. If people are illegal, how are they paying taxes? The IRS is actually really good at collecting taxes, and they make it very easy for immigrants, whether they're documented or undocumented immigrants, to pay taxes. And so many immigrants, particularly any immigrant who receives his or her salary in a check, they're paying taxes, and they're paying Social Security. They're paying all of the things that any working person pays. Now, some people are being paid under the table because they're working in a cash economy. And again, getting back to your question about DACA, what's the point of it? Well, the whole point is to eliminate that underground economy. Just as we should be paying taxes on our babysitters and the people who mow our lawns, well, if we extend that even more to have a system by which everyone is able to easily be part of that official economy where you are paying taxes and ideally at some point getting some of the benefits of that, remember now that the immigrant community, the undocumented immigrant community, pays into Social Security but will never be able to take out of Social Security. So there are millions of dollars being put in every year to the Social Security system by undocumented workers who will never get that back. And, of course, those of us who do withdraw or do plan to withdraw from the Social Security system, we should be saying thank you.
Yes, indeed. DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. How could our listeners learn more about this initiative?
Well, the U.S. government has quite a bit of information on it. United States Customs and Immigration Services, USCIS.gov. That's the government website for immigration. They actually have an extraordinary amount of information in English and Spanish and Vietnamese and Tagalog and Chinese. And I'm not sure how many other languages, but a lot of information is out there about what DACA is, about what the rules for immigration are. United We Dream, which is that organization that I mentioned earlier, by and for immigrant youth. Excellent, excellent organization with a really fun website. They've got some good graphic designers working for them. So it's a very compelling website.
So you would just plug into the computer United We Dream.
United We Dream.
That. And what's the other website that you gave us?
USCIS. And that is the official government website for immigration. And again, they have an extraordinary amount of information. They also have some great, it's a wonderful website to be familiar with. They have, for example, the test. You can practice the test for citizenship, and I think it'd be interesting to see how many U.S. citizens would be able to pass that test. It's actually,
That's right.
The naturalization exam is really quite a humbling experience, I think, for most of us to realize that immigrants, when they come in, have to learn quite a bit about our civics that we may not have.
Yes, they do, and they should.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we should also have, through the years, gained a lot of that information ourselves.
We'd hope.
Dr. Erica Sutherland, thank you so much. Our time is up.
Well, thank you for having me.
We appreciate your coming over to our microphones here at WDIY.
Well, I appreciate the invitation.
And we hope to see you in the future.
I hope so, too.
Congratulations on your work with students and getting students out of the bubble that's on campus, which a lot of times we think of. You know, out there into the real world.
It's the real world out there, and we hope to have them ready for it.
And remember, until we meet again, to be gentle with your neighbor.